whoever you are, wherever you are, and whenever it is, you're catching some rain waves coming to you from the banks of the rapidly flowing and fluvial St. Vrain River in almost always sunny Longmont, Colorado. I'm Becky Peters, and across the table is the co-host who needs no introduction, Ben Kalb. Ben, what's good?
It's all good, Becky. Just sitting here feeling insanely grateful that we have the opportunity to interview rock stars in education and bring their ideas, advice, and strategies to the earbuds of my favorite people group in the whole world, busy teachers. And we do all of this to make us more informed, inspired, and connected educators.
Rock stars is an understatement. The past 2 weeks, we've featured New York Times bestselling authors, and their advice and stories are so powerful. So if you aren't caught up yet, make sure you go back and listen. All of our episodes are available wherever you get your podcasts. And while our author today hasn't made it onto the New York Times bestselling list yet, I know he is destined for huge success because of how valuable this book is.
Totally. Yeah, I binge read his book faster than season one of Stranger Things. His book, Intention, Critical Creativity in the Classroom, is that good that it is bingeable. And the premise of the book is that critical thinking and creativity go hand in hand. I've worked in other districts and other places where teachers or principals will say something like, we don't have time for that creative stuff yet because our students are struggling too much with reading or writing, or maybe we can do some of that cool creative stuff once we learn our math facts.
Yeah, you're totally right. I see that all the time. And this book does an amazing job of showing how you can and how you should be combining critical thinking with creativity as a way of engaging students in learning and helping students think about something deeper. Einstein said creativity is intelligence at play. And this book is basically a recipe book of high-tech, low-tech, and no-tech strategies that students can use to think critically while being creative.
And while Dan Ryder has tons of these examples in this interview, we're going to go over a few of our favorite strategies that require our students to think critically and be creative at the same time. So, hey Siri, what time is it?
It's time to get out of our heads and into the classroom.
I need help!
Somebody, please help me.
Help me!
Give me something I can use.
Let's get out of our heads into the classroom.
Great, so it's out of our heads into the classroom, the part of the show where we give tangible tips, actionable advice, and ready-to-use strategies. One of the recipes I loved from the book, Critical Creativity, is an activity called Frankenword, kind of like Frankenstein, but Frankenword. Essentially, you have students create a brand new word by mashing up two or more vocabulary terms. A teacher out at Erie Elementary, one of our elementary schools, who read this book, started off calling it Frankenword, but one of her students said that he liked to call it Word Smash more, which I think is a cool name too. But it's where students show mastery of multiple vocabulary terms in a unit by creating a new definition. So maybe a kid mashes up the word condensation and evaporation to evapensation, which would be like the water droplets that form on top of something that's suspended over water, where those two things are happening at the same time. So it could be no tech. Kids could do it in a notebook. Or now in the new iOS update, kids could open pages and then type their definition and also draw a picture of what it would look like. There are lots of possibilities for that.
Yeah, I love this strategy. Love me some Frankenword, and I've used it in lots of different contexts with both students and teachers, and it's really a fast activity that shows deep understanding of something. And we would love if our listeners could give us a Frankenword describing Vrain Waves. So mash up two words that describe how you feel about the show and tweet it to us, like, wow, Vrain Waves is so infotaining, which would be both informational and entertaining, hopefully.
Infotaining. I like that one. I've got a good one, too. I got to slow down to say it, though. Inform-perected. Like, ooh. Informed, inspired, and connected.
Ooh, giddy up.
Yeah. All right, Ben, what's your strategy for having kids think creatively and critically?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Dan is a friend of the pod, and I don't want to give away all of his strategies. So there's 40-something, and we don't want to give them all away. So I'm going to think outside of his book and go to a place that is not an original idea, but a strategy that I love, and it is called the six-word story. So Mark Twain once in a letter wrote, I didn't have time to write a short letter, so I wrote a long one. And I think we all know that it is much harder to communicate something concisely than it is to just word vomit. And so having students put something in a small package actually shows a lot of deep understanding around an idea. The six-word story is a really awesome way to force your students to be concise with their understanding. And the origin of where the six-word story comes from has been debated, but one of the backstories I like the most is that Ernest Hemingway was at a restaurant with a bunch of other writers, and they were debating who could write the most compelling short story. And they put some money on it. And Ernest Hemingway said, I can tell a great story in six words or less. and on a napkin he wrote "For sale, baby shoes never worn," and then he passed the napkin around his table and collected his winnings, because there are so many emotions conveyed in that six-word story. So I've seen teachers do this a lot using six-word stories. They've had students summarize a chapter that they've read, summarize a book they've read, a historical period. So in October, I was out at Coleridge Middle School, and the sixth grade language arts team there did an awesome activity where they had students write six-word stories that conveyed a sense of fear in their listeners. And then they took those six-word stories and they hopped into GarageBand and used live loops to bring in instruments that would enhance that sense of fear. And so you had students bring in some strings or some minor piano riffs. And it was really awesome to see the different types of fear that students played in with their six-word stories. The ones I remember, a kid wrote, "I will never outrun this clown." It's like a really scary like violin playing behind it. Someone else had like a really heavy orchestra and "total nuclear war," declared the president. And someone else had like a Jaws type theme and "surfboard, dangling feet, shark bait." So a really cool activity, six-word story. Give it a shot.
I love it. So that was Out of Our Heads and Into the Classroom. You'll have tons more examples like that with our guest today, Mr. Dan Ryder. He is an Apple Distinguished Educator and author of the blog Wicked Decent. Check it out. And co-author of the aforementioned book Intention, Critical Creativity in the Classroom.
Yeah. In this episode, we talk about how design thinking can be used in any subject, why critical thinking and creativity should not be separated but put together, and several more strategies you can use in class tomorrow.
Can you start off by telling us your name, who you are, where you teach, what you teach?
Sure. My name is Dan Ryder. I teach at Mount Blue High School in Farmington, Maine. I've been there for about 20 years now. For 19 of those years, I've been an English teacher, but this year I have a new role. My new title for at least the next 3 years is Education Director of our new Success and Innovation Center.
Oh my gosh, no way. That's so exciting.
It's super exciting. It's like the dream job has happened. It's landed. It's there. I'm teaching one course right now, and I'm co-teaching it with another English teacher. I launched a design thinking course as its own elective. This is the first year we're doing that. In terms of in the classroom, is I'm able now to co-teach with the entire campus. I'll have an English teacher will say, "Hey, can we do something together around this Lord of the Flies project?" The kids come in and I kind of teach the class based on what the teacher's saying the needs are, but the teacher hasn't gone anywhere. She's right there. And we're kind of working together, and I just guide us through some design process work or some intentionality work or some critical creativity work, whatever that piece is that teacher doesn't feel 100% comfortable with, or sometimes it's not even 100% comfort. Sometimes it's just these kids need to hear it from a different voice.
I'm curious for you, like, how did you get involved in design thinking? When did you start using it in your classroom? When you were an English teacher, and how did you kind of follow that path towards where you're at now?
So I got involved with design thinking through Twitter. Yay, Twitter.
Nice.
About 5 years ago. It was a summer night. It was a balmy night. I was sitting at our high school in the construction zone, and I said, I should really get on Twitter this evening. And I don't know why. Well, I was thinking about promoting our own podcast at the time. And I went on, I saw this reference to this thing called design thinking. And I was like, "What's that?" And then it said there was a Twitter chat. And I said, "What's that?" And then there was a hashtag. And I went, "Huh, I'm not even sure what that is." So I clicked on the hashtag and saw that it was a live conversation. And I've never looked back. It's just been one fantastic ride since then. That community on Twitter completely transformed my career and transformed how I approach teaching and learning. It started with that one evening, and they have become my tribe. They are some of my best friends in the world are members of that community. And we've kept it going solid ever since. And it's all about integrating design thinking into the edu space, whether that's pre-K or higher ed and everything in between. And it's been awesome.
Nice. So I follow you on Twitter, and I want to tell our listeners how to follow you on Twitter. It's at Wicked Decent. And I'm curious, I mean, I have an inkling about where it might have come from, but where does that name come from?
Well, geez, that's because everything up here in Maine is Wicked Decent. Unless it's like kind of freaking terrible, So yeah, it's just, it's a homage, as one might say, to my heritage up here.
Fair.
Yeah, that's it. But that's it. You know, there's like, there's wicked good, but we like to take it to the next level.
Which is wicked decent.
Wicked decent.
One of the things that Becky has coined, and she has trademarked this saying, is let's get out of the head and into the classroom. So one of the goals of this podcast is to give some tangible takeaway things that teachers can do the next day in their classroom. So with you just saying that you used a lot of design thinking, can you tell us about your favorite design challenge or design thinking project that you did in your English class?
Sure. So my favorite one for my English class was I had my students design tiny houses for the characters in Of Mice and Men.
Nice.
So the design challenge was, how might we design a tiny house for four characters from Of Mice and Men? Wow. And those four characters are the four with the dream, right? So you've got George and Lenny, but then you've also got Candy and Crooks, right? So those are the four that share the dream. And so they had to decide who they wanted to design for, and I challenged them to design for more than one user at a time. And I really pushed them to design for all four. And they had to make it to scale. They had to follow the creative constraints were that they had to follow the principles of design thinking. Of tiny house living. Mm. Right. So it was like, it couldn't be bigger than, I want to say it was 500 square feet. Had to fit inside of that. It might have been slightly larger than that, but it was small. They had to build it to scale. So they had to consider how big the actual individuals are. Like, they had to take into account from inference from reading what, you know, how big are these people, what they need for space. They had to, you know, fully furnish it. They had to figure out where the lighting is, and one of the challenges was to make it off, you know, sustainable. Mm-hmm. All the principles of sustainability and good ecological design, and integrate all of that based on authentic understanding of the text. Everything had to have text evidence to back up a choice.
Nice.
So they had to do empathy maps to understand what the characters are saying, what they're thinking, what they're feeling, what they're doing, so they could show that they truly have perspective. They had to do a prototype. They had to make a physical model to scale of what that tiny house is. They could use any materials they wanted to do it. They could work inside their own wheelhouse there. They could also work digital if they wanted. Several made theirs in Minecraft. Nice. A few made theirs in other 3D dimensional rendering tools. I'm trying to remember all the ones that were used, but I know one student made theirs in Maya. Somebody made theirs in another game design engine. I can't remember which one off the top of my head. Point being, they could use any materials they wanted as long as it was to scale. And then at the end, they have to do this thing I created called an intention map, where they have to map over the empathy evidence that they've acquired from their reading and their work, connect that to specific points of their design, explain how that connection exists, and what they would do differently on a future iteration.
That sounds like an amazing project.
Yeah, yeah. The idea is to do authentic empathy as best as we can with fictional characters.
Yep.
But the idea is that the principles of design thinking and the mindset of design thinking can be applied to the world of literary analysis, but also meeting the needs of humans.
That's awesome. We have some teachers that are doing some pretty incredible design challenges in classrooms. And I some of the ones on literacy and main characters are some of my favorite, because it just requires so much empathy building around that character. And like you said, textual evidence, that's really incredible.
Cool.
Leads me into about your book too. Like, when you, so you, in your book called Intention, for our listeners who haven't read it yet, I'd love for you to talk just about that book, where the ideas came from, and what it's about.
My friend Amy Burval and I, my co-author on it, we made fast friends at South by Southwest years ago. And it was basically because we realized that we were creatively compatible. We had all these ideas that we just go, oh yeah, oh, and you could, and we could, oh yeah. We just shoot ideas about what you could do in your classroom back and forth all the time, and what you could do just as a creative exploration, and just these kind of foolishly ridiculous ideas and notions that when you thought about for a couple minutes, you go, wait a minute, no, wait, we could do this. This is how to make that work as a learning experience, and a really authentic and important one. So we just had all of these ideas of, that we kind of put under these categories of critical creativity and rigorous whimsy. And
yes,
the idea being that through creative expression, you can deepen your content understanding. The two things don't have to be separate. We don't have to have creativity happening in this bucket and then academic learning happening in this bucket. The two can go together really easily once you start getting yourself in that mindset.
Is that where the term edusymbiosis comes from? I see that pop up a lot in the book.
Yeah. Edusymbiosis is the idea of bringing together all of those disciplines and ways of thinking together to work together as a common whole for learning, right? And to true understanding. That's where you get the edusymbiosis, right? That's when the creativity is informing, the critical thinking is informing, the academic knowledge is informing, and so on and so forth.
I love that too about your book, because I think that's what every teacher wants. And your book really gives some very practical ideas on how to do that.
That's what we're trying to do, right? Because like you were saying, get out of that head and right into the classroom. So we've both read tons of theory. And what we really wanted was something that could provide a little theoretical backbone and some philosophy so that it's not like, where are all these ideas coming from? What's the secret sauce that holds them all together? But then 2/3 of the book is 40 plus activities that you can do in any classroom, K-12, any content area. We tried to create an indexing system so people knew, okay, we're creating with our bodies for this. And this one goes well with, oh, let's see. Oh, it goes well with world language. It goes well with health. It goes well with math. And it goes well with social studies. Cool. And if you use the way the book is indexed is to allow you to like kind of jump around and look for the things that speak to you and spark an idea and inform those ideas with your own content and what's important to you in the classroom.
I got to thank you, man, because you have made my job this year so much easier, because I've started every PD that I facilitate with one of those activities, and the
nice
teachers and stuff just absolutely love it. And I think you do an awesome job of showing how creativity and critical thinking go hand in hand with those activities. Could you tell me your top three, and then I'll tell you my favorite one that I've been doing? And then no,
all right,
you want the other 37 to read the book.
All right. Top three. Intention Oreo is one of my absolute favorites. That's the Oreo challenge, where someone has to, a student has to demonstrate their understanding of a concept using only an Oreo cookie as their materials. That's one of my favorites. My second favorite is Potent Quotables, which is combining image and text to create like a social media friendly image that you would spread out throughout the world. And oh, for my third favorite, I'm going to go with the, you know, the top two. I'm always doing those two. Because I love them so much. I'm going to go with one word. The one word from, I think that's in the Imagine Ed area, like where it's just like, what's a single word and how can you illustrate that single word? Because I like the simplicity of it. That's Amy's, and like that really came out of Amy's work. And I just love how you can challenge students to think in a way that's both expansive and concise at the same time. Like they've really got to distill down to a single concept, but then the way they present that concept could be really powerful and unique and creative. So those are my three.
Well, I have
off the top of my head
been geeking out. The last PD I did, I had teachers do Frankenword, where you take two vocabulary
words
and combine them into one. And that was awesome. And then I led a group of students and we did the color palette activity. Which,
yes.
Awesome. Can you explain the color palette activity, since you made it? It's probably way better than my explanation, but explain color palette and how you used it, especially in English class.
So color palette is one of my favorites. Like when you said get down to three, like I'm like, oh man, I got to leave out color. I also talk about color palette all the time, so I tend to leave it out sometimes when I'm talking about it with different people. So the idea behind a color palette is that you create a symbolic color palette for any text using, you can use anything you want. You can use markers, colored pencils. I like to use a digital tool called colorlovers.com, color with a U, because you can create a palette right there that's then shareable and has all the hex codes. The idea is if you read a text, like you're, say you read a poem, throw a famous poem on the table. Like, crap, I've got all AP crap in my head right now.
How about two roads diverging, a wood and I took the one less traveled mile.
Yeah. That is.
Oh, there we go.
Yeah, that's the.
Because I'm actually diverging into woods right now.
There you go.
as I talk to you.
Robert Frost.
Right, so good old Robbie Frost. We look through that poem and we might go, all right, what color makes me think of a split and also winter? And I might choose like a dark gray because it's both a black and a white, right? And so I'm going to call that divergent. That's going to be the name of this shade of gray I've chosen.
Nice.
And then snow, I'm going to choose just a slight off-white. And that's snowy evening. And it's going to be just this kind of like soft white, but maybe I might like, because I can pull through on a digital color palette, kind of pull from the white towards maybe like a yellow. So it's like evening, or maybe even like towards a pink. So you get this kind of white with maybe a pink hue in it. And I'll call that snowy evening. And it also reminds me of how like when snow falls at sunset, it almost looks pink, right? So I'm going to go with that. And then maybe my third color would be something like the stop. Like I might call it full stop. Right? Are you guys still there?
Oh yeah.
Oh shoot. Okay. I'm sorry. I just heard a click and I'm like, oh, I'm in the woods of Maine. And it was a scale up.
Right? So my, like,
yeah, man. I'm just picking right? colors.
Yeah.
Right. And I'm trying to remember the lines of the poem, right? So I'm really just going with those first few lines.
That's cool.
I pick those colors, I tie it directly to text. And then on Color Lovers, I can actually put in a note if I wanted to, but it doesn't matter. I make the palette. I screenshot that palette, tell the kids, keep your hex codes. Make sure you have that. Make sure you have those either jotted down or keep a link to your palette there on Color Lovers. And then in like a blog post or a Google Doc or a Pages document, doesn't you can do it with any of them. You're going to write up your analysis. You're going to break down that poem. Maybe you're going to color the lines of the poem in that color and change the font to match that. But the most important part isn't doing that pretty little color palette or doing those pretty little colors on the text. It's explaining why you named the color, what you named it, how that contributes to your understanding of the meaning of the poem. And then I might say, now do a slide. I want you to do a slide using an excerpt from the poem. And I want the color palette for your slide to be using those colors that you chose from your color palette. And then the kids might go like, but my colors don't go together. And I go, then you don't have a color palette. You just have a random collection of colors. Make a choice. Make a more deliberate, intentional choice. So that, and there's the edusymbiosis, right? Everything is working together at the same time. Hmm. And not just being this kind of random collection of what I happen to have available to me in the moment.
And that's why the whole book, man, is what I love is that you're having students make intentional choices and then explain the thinking that went behind that, that it's not about a flashy video or a really cool looking infographic. It's about the choices that they make and the critical thinking that goes into their creative choices. That's what I love about your book. So thanks for sharing.
Oh, that's awesome. Thanks. Hey, I'm glad that's what you're getting out of it. Cause that's the whole point. Like things can be but ugly.
Yeah.
And still be full of intention.
Yeah.
Right? Like, and so, not to discount aesthetics. Amy Burrell will be like, but aesthetics are important too. They're really good. We know so many people get hung up about art because they worry about what it looks like.
Yep.
Rather than worrying about what the thinking is, right?
Yep.
And if looks mattered, I wouldn't be married to my wife. So I think it's a great point. On her end, not mine. I think, yeah. Okay.
So I want to ask
good
you
job qualifying that.
About, so in the book too, and it kind of goes along with this whole idea of intentionality and the edusymbiosis, but you talk a few times about how teachers can get more creative too around the standards and the kind of projects that they create. And you guys mentioned a couple times like how you can develop a lot and practice a lot of creativity by unpacking standards. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So it doesn't have to be. Unpacking standards can be the worst part of teaching in the modern era, right? Like, because it can just be this exercise in minutia. And if we look at it as a trap, right? Like, or with a cynical or jaundiced eye. Like, here's your standard, and you think, dude, is what they want me to do this? Because that's insane, right? And we go into it with this, like, negative approach. Or we can go and say, what is it that they are asking us to do, and how might we do that? Yes. Like, it goes back to that design thinking, right? That that posture of possibility. What are all the things that we could do within this, right? And as you start unpacking a standard, it's like, okay, what it's really asking me to do is not write an essay. It's not even telling me how they need to demonstrate it. It's simply saying what the kid needs to know or be able to do.
Yeah.
So within that, how expansive can it be? It says they need to write a 5-paragraph essay. Maybe that's what it says, right? It doesn't. I haven't seen a standard that says that, right? Common Core doesn't say 5-paragraph essay. It says composition can structure composition in an organized manner that maintains a point of view or something to that effect, right?
Yep.
So you say, so whose point of view do you want it to be? Well, it should be the kids. Why? Why does it need to be the kids? Why don't they write a personal essay from the point of view of someone else in their class? And see if they can truly empathize with that person, right? And then they're like, do some deep dive on empathy. See if you can really get inside of that other person's perspective. And then write a personal experience narrative from their point of view. All in first person, but it's you are a classmate. And it only needs to be a page long, but it needs to be like well-considered, thoughtful, well-organized, needs to flow, make sense, have voice, all this, but it can't be your voice. It needs to be the voice of your partner, the person that you're designing for, that you're trying to articulate for them, and maybe you make it a problem. What a problem they're having a hard time articulating to others, hard time talking about. Awesome. So you're going to be their voice. You're going to write it for them and try to capture their voice and articulate it in a way that they feel that if they gave that to somebody else, it would capture how they feel about XYZ situation.
I think that's excellent for a number of reasons, but really what struck me about it is that you guys, again, you talk a lot in the book about how creativity really thrives with constraints and with boundaries. There's even a quote in there that like the frame is the most beautiful part of the picture. And you know, we can talk about that. And like you said, you know, we can get in a negative headspace with our standards and all the technicalities in them, or we can let that be our beautiful constraint and use that as
yes.
like, to elevate our practice. That's awesome.
I love what you said about elevating, right? Like what you just said about elevating, that's it, right? Like push ourselves to go a little bit higher, not work harder.
Yes.
Just push that level of critical thinking a little more. And then you can drop things that you've been doing that aren't doing that. You know, like you don't have to do this and the other. You could just do this. It will be okay.
So I have a question, and I'm really curious about this. Like, so that idea that you just talked about, where students interview somebody else for a point of view in their classroom, do you find that it's, like, how do you practice being creative? How do you get better at coming up with ideas like this? And do you find that you need other people around you to help bounce ideas off of? Like, how do you become this person that you are now, and how do we help other people gain that mindset?
I think the most important thing for me has been that since I was a little kid, I haven't been encouraged to be intellectually curious. I've had people around me all the time who are like, have you seen this? Have you listened to this? Have you watched that? Have you experienced this? It puts you in a mindset where everything is interesting to you.
Yeah.
So I get my ideas from listening to 30 or 40 different podcasts that I kind of love, and I can't listen to all of them, so I pick and choose, but I have my little bundle that I come and go through, and they range in interest from everything from gender studies and current issues and civil rights. I mean, instead of being vague, I should just be like, okay, so I listen to like Uncivil, which is all about the Civil War and the forgotten history of the Civil War. And I listen to that, and then I listen to Code Switch, and then I listen to Reply All, and then I listen to Design Matters, and then I listen to All Songs Considered, and then I listen to WTF with Marc Maron. And then I listen to The Nerdist. And then I listen to, like...
And now
I
you listen to Brainwaves. Love,
yes, that's right.
Now I listen to Brainwave, right? I listen to Across the Hall podcast, which is another one of my favorites. I listen to Radio Zamunda with my buddies Otto and Kwaku. Like, yes. I love ideas and I love thinking. And So I'm curious. I surf through Netflix and I surf through Amazon and I watch documentaries about things that I don't know anything about, but just seem interesting to me. And if the documentary stinks, I turn it off. But you know, it's that I don't read beginning to end of almost any book. I just read like big chunks of everything that I can like find an interest in that week.
So you say, are you saying like a lot of really creativity then comes from like being curious?
Yeah, it comes from being curious and it comes from having access, right? Mm. I have access to all this information and more than I could ever possibly go through.
Yeah.
And so all those things that have influenced my identity of who I am as a person, that are still a huge part of me. I try to work all that stuff in that I'm passionate about into my teaching. And as a result, that kind of challenges me to constantly go, oh, you know what we could do? Oh, that would be cool if. Oh, what if? And then it really helps to have some co-conspirators around. And the nice thing about the internet is if you can't find one down the hall from you, you can find one online. And there'll be somebody who has a similar idea who's like, cool, I want to try that too. And that's why Twitter has been absolutely essential to my growth. Especially in the last 5 years.
That's an excellent soundbite because I really want everybody. Twitter helps me so much.
Oh yeah, for sure.
I want everybody to be on Twitter.
Right.
So you said you don't read any book cover to cover, and I don't judge you for that. But
very rarely, I should say, I very rarely read a book cover to cover. They do happen though. They do happen.
Well, what book has changed your practice and how you teach more than any other book?
I would say A Whole New Mind by Dan Pink.
Yes, I love that book.
Tell us why.
Right. So 2000 came out, what, 2006, 2007?
Like yeah.
Right. Something like that,
high
right?
School.
Shut up, Ben.
Shut up, Ben. you whippersnapper, get off my lawn. Right. So when Ben was graduating from high school, I was working at a university for a year.
Right on.
And I was working at my alma mater. The University of Maine at Farmington, and one of the professors there said, oh my gosh, you have to read this book, Dr. Grace. Dr. Grace is amazing. And she said, you have to read this book. And I was in the process of about to adopt my daughter at the time. And I'm like, I don't have time to do this. And she's like, no, you have to, here. And she just stuck the book in my hand and said, take it for the summer, do with it what you will. And I took it and I read it on the beach at camp. While we were waiting to hear about whether or not we could go get our daughter from Florida, it opened my mind up like I wasn't prepared for. Mm-hmm. It completely changed how I saw learning, how I saw multiple intelligences, how I saw work readiness, how I saw future readiness. It just grabbed a hold of that part of my brain that desperately needed a renewed sense of purpose as an educator. Because I'd been through, is my classroom the writing lab? Is my classroom the reading lab? Is my classroom he's just the young, coolest of the lame teachers classroom. Like, what is my identity? What's my purpose? What am I doing? Am I the arts integration guy? Am I the what? Like, what is this? And when I read that, I was like, oh my gosh, I want to be the thinking guy. Like, I want to be the one who, if nothing else, teaches them how to think and not what to think, but how to think.
Yeah.
And to think about how their brains are organized and think about, semantic meanings and think about schema and all that good stuff. And I might not use those words, but that's what I'm trying to do. I started, teamed up with a guy to start a humanities class right after that. We started a humanities class and that was our text. That was the central text for the year. We built everything out of that. And I constantly go back to it. And then I find out, then I learn about design thinking. And it's like, oh yeah, empathy. one of the part of the Whole New Mind, right? Like that's central to Whole New Mind. So that one book, that's the one that changed everything. And if people haven't read it, go out and grab it because it's still super relevant.
Absolutely. Very, very relevant. And Daniel Pink is actually a guest on a future episode of Rainwave. So we have that to look forward to. So, Dan, we believe that we all learn from failures. So we are curious, what was your biggest failure as a teacher and what did you learn from it?
Man, I've never failed. That's weird. Is
that's why you're an
eight. What's that like?
It's lucky for you.
Yeah.
Right? It must be awkward. I mean, I'm pretty much infallible last time I checked.
Yeah.
No, I fail often. And usually with substantial amounts of collateral damage, unintentionally. I don't know if I have a great, like, this one fail story, but I do have a general failure as an educator that I speak of pretty openly and honestly. And that is, I am the absolute worst at timely feedback.
Mm.
I am really, really good in the moment. I'm really good at designing assessment. I'm really good at creating engaging experiences that have kids interact with the content in a way that's meaningful and purposeful and all that good stuff. And I'm really good at giving feedback when they're there and I'm seeing it and we're talking about it and we're having a conversation around it. I'm really good in those moments. I am absolutely horrible about, they've turned it in, I need to put comments on it and get it back to them in a timely manner. Like, it just, I can't describe to you how awful I am at that. And it is without a doubt my Achilles heel as an educator. It screws things up for kids. It's bad for kids. It messes things up for them. It causes stress. It makes me a bad person. It makes me a worse dad. It makes me a worse husband. I mean, but it's true. Like, all of this is true. I love my current role. The most relieving part of my current role is the amount of grading I have to do has gone has gone down by 80%. Right.
Yeah.
And I think the kids in our school are the better for it.
Yep.
Because I'm not grading things.
Oh my God.
And not because I give bad feedback or I'm bad at feedback. I'm bad at timely.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because I'm putting so much energy into the experience and the other things and trying to be everything for every kid and trying to balance this and being involved in that. You know, I had a teacher, I had a teacher who was there when I first started and he was one of the wizened, you know, veterans. And I didn't always agree with a lot of the things he said or a lot of things he did. He was not harmful. He was just hilariously like antiquated. But the thing he said to me, and I'll never forget it, is he said, "Damn it, boy. There will always be time to grade, but those kids are coming through the door and you need to have something important for them."
Absolutely.
Every day. And I was like, and I've taken that to heart and to an extreme to the point where I'm kind of terrible about assessing and getting feedback to kids. But man, don't I love when there's time and I can set a day and say, "I'm meeting with every kid and we're going to go over their stuff."
Totally.
And I'm going to sit down with you with your essay. And I'm going to sit with you with your project. I'm going to tell you how like great it is and then how absolutely terrible it is. And everything that and we're going to talk about possibilities, how you might improve it. And we're going to get you, you know, to where you need to go. And we're going to make sure that your grade is authentic. We're going to make sure that the grade in the grade book like feels congruent to what what I know it should be to what you think it should be and make sure that we're on the same page. Yeah. So I'm not bad at grading. I'm just bad at time.
Finding time for it. Yeah. And I had a teacher, a veteran teacher, say something similar to me, that teaching is like juggling a bunch of balls and you have to figure out which ones are glass and you can't drop. And you're right. I think having engaging activities for kids to do, authentic experiences, probably is higher up on that priority list. But yeah, definitely hard to find time for all that kind of stuff.
Right. And
just a little plug for our teachers.
Like that growth piece. Oh yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah. I think I've seen some teachers use their drive, teachers who have far drives, to leave audio comments, you know, on kids' works, just using the audio recorder on their iPhone or iPad. So using automated graders inside of Schoology or a Google extension, or doing activities that students give each other feedback. But I think that was definitely my weakest point as a teacher too. So I definitely pick up what you're throwing down on that.
You know what has really improved things for me? I was doing audio comments, then I realized I was leaving like 5 minutes of audio comment. And then I did the math and I went, oh, that's problematic.
Yeah.
Okay. So let me ask you this then.
I really love text, speech to text. Yeah. Google Talk, like the on Google has improved dramatically, like in the last year.
Yeah.
Like it's so, the AI on it is so much better than it ever was. And I found that super helpful.
And that might be it, but so if you're inefficient at giving timely feedback, what's one thing that you've, like a time-saving hack as a teacher? Like what have you gotten much, much better at since like your first couple of years up until now?
So a couple of things have worked out really well. One, I don't grade every single thing. One of my favorite things I came up with was having them, and I just took it from like a writer's workshop. Like, I'm not sure whose it was. It could have been anybody's. But I just kind of like remixed one of their ideas. And so I have students blog, and they blog like once or twice a week. And then what I'd have them do is every 3 weeks, choose your best blog post. You choose your best work.
Ooh, nice.
Right? Now, yeah, awesome. I'm expecting that you have turned them in, and here's where I expect to see them. And I expect to see, I have them link them on a spreadsheet, on a Google spreadsheet, and then I use a color coding system to let them know I've read it. And if there's like a problem with their link, I like it's green means they make it green if they're ready for it to have it assessed. Yellow means that there's a problem with their link, and I change it to yellow. And then blue means I've assessed it, and you can check your grades. But what I did is I had the master schedule with all their topics, and the topics are like there's a link to the blog post that has explained everything they need to do, but they have their topics, and then I use separate worksheets to be like the turn-in-date for like best evidence. So they had to pick their best evidence through this time span, and then their best evidence through this time span. Then I'm only assessing what they actually think is their best work. We're having conversations about what best work looks like and good things like that. But then that reduced my grading load from I was assessing 12 blog posts a student per quarter. Multiply that by 80. You can do the math, right?
Yeah, that's insane.
Sounds like a million. I'm not a math guy, but I think it's like a million.
Billion, something like that.
Close, right. Yeah.
No wonder you couldn't get
right. Between a billion and a million thousand.
Yeah.
It's like a million thousand. I didn't have time. So that was a hack that helped me kind of like go, you know what? I could just assess their best work.
Right.
And have them have that conversation with me.
Because there's nothing worse than if it wasn't their best work, they don't really care what you think anyways. You know, I would spend all this time grading and see it right in the recycling afterwards. So I think you're right about giving them work that they care about and then only assessing their best work.
And I'd tell any kid that I would, you know, if you want feedback on all your stuff, let's just set up a time and we'll go through them together.
Yep, totally.
Right, because we'll just have a conversation about it. Or tell me the one you really want me, you know, you're turning this one in for grades, but you really want to know what I think about blank. Okay. Like, awesome. Sweetie. Just let me know and I'll gladly do it. And I'll do it quickly. Like, if you ask personally, if it's just part of the pile, it's not getting taken care of anytime soon. And it's always a digital pile these days too.
Yeah.
It's always a digital pile.
Well, Dan, it sounds like you've arrived. You've traversed through the woods successfully. We thank you so much for giving us your time. And again, your book rocked my world, man. Where can our listeners go to learn more from you?
So to find out more about the book, they can visit intentionthebook.online. And you'll find excerpts from the book on there. You'll find our creativity credo. You'll find our lexicon, like our vocabulary or lexicon of creativity, and find ways that you can follow us and connect with us. How to buy the book is all on there and cool stuff like that. And then you can follow me on social media @WickedDecent. I'm on Twitter and Instagram and Medium. Those are my three social places of choice. I'm also on Facebook, but I've yet to like really use Facebook as a professional tool the way a lot of people are. I'm not like anti using it. I'm just like, it's I'm still like getting used to doing that.
I mostly just use it for poking. And your MySpace, what's your MySpace account? Or Zanga?
Oh yeah. So, I'm trying to remember. It's either my Friendster or my MySpace. Let's see.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Okay. I like it.
Right. Yeah. Right. So you can check me out at altavista.com/geocities.11dancinghamster.
That's amazing, man.
I love it.
Well, hey, thank you a million.
Yeah, seriously.
Hopefully we talk soon.
Thank you so much, Dan, for your time.
Oh, thank you for inviting me on.
All right, Ben, let's close up shop. What'd you learn?
I learned that the real power comes from having students make intentional choices and then describe the thinking that went behind those choices. So it's not enough to just have a beautiful looking slide with really colors that match, but having students describe, why did you choose the colors you chose, and why did you make the creative choices that you made? And that is how critical thinking and creativity go hand in hand. How about you, Becky?
That's awesome. I want to build on that one too. We've been doing design thinking a lot in the STEM schools in our district. And all the time when I ask a student to explain their prototype, it's never just there's never any part of it that's not completely intentional. Like, oh, this little piece of string hanging off the side of it, which looks messy, is actually like the sensor that takes information from the air filter. And you know what I mean? It's all so intentional. And I think it really displays what students are thinking about critically while they're being creative. I also appreciated the thought that creativity isn't a privilege that just high achieving students should have, but that all students should have the opportunity to be creative to show their critical thinking.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you again for listening. Thank you for all the feedback. If you like the show, we would love if you could share it with a friend. And a 5-star review in Apple Podcasts helps us inform, inspire, and connect even more amazing educators.
And since we don't know what time you're listening, have an awesome generic time of day.